right, jumping into the reading of today's Boston Globe for this Wednesday, the 18th of February, 2026. With the Boston Globe on the Talking Information Center, we say hello to Pamela.
Good morning, and our lead story from the front page, A Powerful Voice for Justice and Inclusion. The Reverend Jesse Jackson, whose impassioned oratory and populist vision of a rainbow coalition of the poor and forgotten made him the nation's most influential black figure in the years between the civil rights crusades of the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. and the election of Barack Obama, died on Tuesday at his home in Chicago. He was 84. His death was confirmed by his family in a statement, which did not give a cause. Reverend Jackson was hospitalized in November for treatment of a rare and particularly severe neurodegenerative condition, progressive supranuclear palsy, according to the advocacy organization he founded, the Rainbow Push Coalition. In 2017, he announced that he had Parkinson's disease. He had picked up the mantle of King after his assassination in 1968 and ran for president twice, long before Obama's election in 2008. But he never achieved either the commanding moral stature of King or the ultimate political triumph attained by Obama. Instead, through the power of his language and his preternatural energy and ambition, he became a moral and political force in a racially ambiguous era, when Jim Crow was still a vivid memory and black political power more an aspiration than a reality. With his gospel of seeking common ground, his pleas to keep hope alive, and his demands for respect for those seldom accorded it, Reverend Jackson enunciated a progressive vision that defined the soul of the Democratic Party, if not necessarily its policies, in the last decades of the 20th century. It was a vision, animated by the Civil Rights era, in which an inclusive coalition of people of color and others who had been at the periphery of American life would now move to the forefront and transform it. My constituency is the desperate, the damned, the disinherited, the disrespected, and the despised, Reverend Jackson said in the rolling cadences of the pulpit at the 1984 Democratic National Convention in San Francisco. They are restless and seek relief. While the overarching theme of the speech was unity, he ended the address by emphasizing the idea of hope and change. I just want young America to do me one favor, just one favor. Exercise the right to dream, he said. He added, our time has come. We must leave the racial battleground and come to the economic common ground and moral high ground. America, our time has come. Reverend Jackson was born Jesse Louise Burns on October 8, 1941, in Greenville, South Carolina. His mother, Helen Burns, was 16 at the time. His father, Noah Lewis Robinson, was a 33-year-old former boxer who lived next door, married to another woman. In 1943, his mother married Charles Jackson before he joined the Army. Jackson did not adopt Jesse until 14 years later. When the couple had a son of their own, Jesse was sent to live with his maternal grandmother in a shotgun shack around the corner. After graduating from high school in 1959, Jackson enrolled at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign on a football scholarship. He transferred after his freshman year to what is now North Carolina Agricultural and Technical State University, a historically black institution in Greensboro. He became a leader in his fraternity and eventually president of the student body. And he fell in love with a vibrant, high-energy student named Jacqueline Lavinia Brown, known as Jackie. They married on New Year's Eve in 1962. Soon, their first child was born, a daughter they named Santita. Four more children followed. After graduating from college in 1964, he enrolled at the Chicago Theological Seminary. It was an impossible time for some of the Reverend Jackson's passions to be lost in scholarly contemplation. Stunned by the beatings of black demonstrators in Selma, Alabama, in March 1965, he climbed atop a table in the seminary's cafeteria and challenged other students to join him on a trip there. About 20 students and a third of the faculty took him up on the call, and they all headed south. There, Reverend Jackson offered his services to members of King's inner circle in the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, irking a few of them by acting as if he were in a position of authority. He met King and went home transformed. 6 months after Selma, while still pursuing his studies, Reverend Jackson became, at 24, the youngest SCLC staff member. He was chosen to head the Chicago chapter of the SLC's Operation Breadbasket, a national economic development campaign whose goal was to use boycotts as a way to pressure white businesses to hire black workers and to purchase goods and services from black contractors. By 1967, he was gaining a national reputation. 6 months before graduating, he quit his seminary studies to plunge into the civil rights movement full-time. He was later ordained by the minister of a Chicago church after he went to work for King. King became an intellectual and a spiritual model, as well as a father figure. Jesse, said Reverend Ralph David Abernathy, perhaps King's closest associate, wanted to be Martin. For all his zeal, Reverend Jackson became the most controversial member of King's inner circle. Though he was part of the leadership, he was also, with his base in Chicago, almost an independent actor. His ego, charisma, and ability to generate press for himself left others in the SLC suspicious of his ambitions and led to clashes, even with King. It all came to a climax in April 1968, when King went to Memphis to show support for striking garbage workers. King was outside his second-floor room at the Lorraine Motel, bantering with SLC colleagues in the parking lot below, before going out to dinner when a single rifle shot shattered the moment. What happened next shadowed the way Reverend Jackson was viewed for decades. He was one of several aides who rushed towards King after he was shot. Later that night, Reverend Jackson hurried back to Chicago, parts of which were in flames in the unrest that followed the assassination. The next morning, he appeared on the Today Show wearing the oval, olive turtleneck sweater, blotted with blood, that he had worn the day before in Memphis. At a memorial convocation of the Chicago City Council that day, he declared, "I come here with a heavy heart, because on my chest is the stain of blood from Dr. King's head." He added, "He went through, literally, a crucifixion. I was there, and I'll be there for the resurrection." At least once publicly, he indicated that he was the last person to speak with King, and that he had held his bloodied head as King lay dying. Others who were there said it never happened. Reverend Jackson's account changed over time, from cradling King's head to reaching toward it. The Reverend Bernice A. King, the youngest daughter of the civil rights legend, on Tuesday praised Reverend Jackson as a gifted negotiator and a courageous bridge builder in a social media post. "My family shares a long and meaningful history with him, rooted in a shared commitment to justice and love." After King's death, Reverend Jackson repeatedly clashed with Abernathy, the new head of the SCLC. In late 1971, their relationship fell apart entirely after Abernathy suspended Reverend Jackson for 60 days for administrative improprieties and repeated acts of violation of organizational policy. Freed from the institutional hierarchy of the SCLC, Reverend Jackson became a ubiquitous presence in American life, promoting social justice causes. Before long, his focus had shifted almost inevitably to a new area, politics. As early as 1971, he flirted with the idea of starting a new political party. In 1980, he became a tireless campaigner for President Carter in his unsuccessful re-election bid. It set the stage for his becoming invaluable to the Democratic Party for success in registering black voters. In 1984, Reverend Jackson decided it was time to campaign for himself as the second black candidate from a major party to run for president, after Shirley Chisholm, the former congressmember from Brooklyn, in 1972. He established the National Rainbow Coalition as a vehicle for a populist campaign. 3 weeks after launching his presidential campaign, in informal conversations with black reporters, he used the offensive terms Haimi and Haimi Town to describe the Jewish population in New York City. The words, reported 37 paragraphs deep in an analytical article in the Washington Post, set off a furor that would hang over for years. Still, fueled by black voters, particularly in the South, whom he had helped register in historic numbers, Reverend Jackson stunned many political observers with the strength he showed in the 1984 race for the Democratic presidential nomination, emerging as the first black candidate to become a serious contender in a national contest. His dramatic 50-minute speech to the convention in San Francisco was perhaps the emotional high point of the doomed Democratic campaign against the popular incumbent, Ronald Reagan. He tried again in 1988, and this time he began as a party heavyweight. In the Super Tuesday primary on March 8th, he ran first or second in 16 of the 21 primaries and caucuses. Party leaders, fearing that they could not win a general election with an assertive left-wing black presidential candidate, desperately looked for an alternative. In the end, Governor Michael Dukakis of Massachusetts won the nomination. Even though Reverend Jackson had earned almost 7 million primary votes, 29% of the total. The party's convention in Atlanta was bittersweet. Reverend Jackson campaigned hard for the vice presidential nomination and was disappointed not to be picked. But again, in a televised speech, he delivered Electrify the Convention. The speech, which he concluded by four times shouting out, "Keep hope alive," was immediately hailed as an American political classic. Reverend Jackson decided against a third presidential run in 1992 when Democrats took back the White House behind Bill Clinton. Clinton made him a special envoy to Africa. As the Democratic Party struggled to adjust to a nation moving to the right, Reverend Jackson became a voice of the marginalized American left, pushing back at the prevailing political winds and speaking out for anti-war and social justice causes. He also faced personal controversies and crisis. In 2001, it was revealed that he had fathered a child, Ashley Jackson, in 1999 with a woman who had worked for his advocacy group, now called, after a merger, the Rainbow Push Coalition. During Obama's presidential run in 2008, Reverend Jackson had to apologize and was rebuked by his own son, Representative Jesse Jackson Jr., for derisive remarks he had made about Obama that was picked up by an open microphone. In addition to his son and his wife, Reverend Jackson leaves his other children, Santita, Jonathan, Yusef, Jacqueline, and Ashley, and a number of grandchildren. Reverend Jackson said he did not regret his runs for the Oval Office. "I was able to run for the presidency twice and redefine what was possible. It raised the lid for women and other people of color," he told the AP. "Part of my job was to sow seeds of the possibilities." Obama acknowledged those efforts, saying he had led some of the most significant movements for change in human history. Michelle Obama got her first glimpse of political organizing at the Jackson's kitchen table when she was a teenager, Obama wrote on X. "And in his two historic runs for president, he laid the foundation for my own campaign to the highest office in the world." Reverend Jackson was relentless in his belief that we are all children of God, deserving of dignity and respect, the Post read. Rhode Island shooter had history of struggle. A daughter of the suspect said her grandparents and a friend were injured and remained hospitalized in critical condition. The suspect also died at the scene. While authorities have not said what prompted Robert Dorgan to shoot and kill family members during a hockey game in Pawtucket on Monday, court records and interviews with friends and family members paint a picture of a complicated life marked by legal disputes and family conflict. Dorgan's daughter, Ava Dorgan, 20, told the Globe Tuesday that her mother, Rhonda Dorgan, and older brother, Aiden Dorgan, were killed when her father opened fire at the Dennis M. Lynch Arena. Her mother's parents were also injured, as was her mother's friend, Thomas Caruso, 54, an assistant principal of a Pawtucket high school. "All three are still hospitalized in critical condition," she said. The family was at the ice rink Monday afternoon to watch her younger brother play hockey for the Blackstone Valley Schools co-op hockey program, said Ava Dorgan, who was not at the game. The younger brother was not injured in the shooting. Pawtucket Police Chief Tina Gonzalez said during a press briefing on Tuesday that several bystanders attempted to stop the shooting, but Dorgan took out a second firearm and shot himself. Video taken during the game captured the sounds of multiple gunshots, followed by an 11-second pause as people scrambled for the exits, and then another single shot. Aiden Dorgan died at the hospital. Rhonda Dorgan succumbed to her injuries at the arena, said Gonsalves. Investigators recovered two firearms, a Glock 10mm and a SIG Sauer P226 pistol, said Gonsalves. Dorgan had license to carry firearms in Florida, she said. Gonsalves called the shooting a very targeted family dispute that remained under investigation. It doesn't appear that there was any conversation or confrontation between the family before the incident happened, said Gonsalves. There was no indication there was going to be violence, the chief added, noting that Robert Dorgan had gone to hockey games before without incident. Robert Dorgan, who is transgender, also went by the names Roberta Dorga and Roberta Esposita. The Globe was not able to confirm whether Dorgan's name was legally changed. Gonsalves said that investigators have not obtained Dorgan's medical records and she could not answer questions regarding mental health struggles or medications. Court records show that after 28 years of marriage, Rhonda Dorgan filed for divorce in February 2020. In the divorce filing, she initially cited gender reassignment surgery, narcissistic plus personality traits, but crossed it out and changed the grounds for divorce to irreconcilable differences which caused the irremediable breakdown of the marriage. The divorce was finalized in June 2021. Ava Dorgan told the Globe that her father had not been violent in the past, but acknowledged her relationship with him had frayed since the divorce. She said she knew her father was transgender, but did not know her father owned guns. We were not close in the last few years, said Ava Dorgan. I don't really want much business out there. I just want them to know that it was my mom and my brother and my dad. That's all. Town records show Robert Dorgan had previously lived at the family home in North Providence. His voter registration there was canceled in 2022. It was not immediately clear where Dorgan was living at the time of the shooting. While friends who knew Robert Dorgan as Roberta described a devoted parent who would drive to Rhode Island for games and events, military, police, and court records paint a more complicated picture. Robert Dorgan joined the Marine Corps in April 1988 and was prematurely discharged that July, the USMC confirmed to the Globe. His discharge is indicative the character of his service was incongruent with Marine Corps expectations and standards, said Marine spokesman Major Jacoby Jetty. Police records show Robert Dorgan was charged with simple assault and battery in Providence in 1989 and with driving on suspended license in 1994. Both charges were dropped. In February 2020, the same month that Rhonda Dorgan filed for divorce, Robert Dorgan accused his mother, Joanne Dorgan, of assault. He received an order of protection. The charges were later dismissed. Also in early 2020, Dorgan told police in North Providence his father-in-law threatened to hire an Asian gang and have him killed if he did not drop charges against his mother, according to a police report. The father-in-law reportedly told Robert Dorgan to move out of the house because in no way a tyranny is going to stay in my... There's no way a tranny is going to stay in my house, according to a police report. Two separate child support cases were filed against Dorgan, one by Heidi J. Wallace, 62, in January 2016, and one by Marlise Dunbar, 57, in May 2016. My family is very, very... We can't talk about this right now, Wallace told the Globe in an interview. Dunbar did not return a call requesting comment on Tuesday. Dorgan also owed thousands of dollars to Capital One Bank and other financial institutions, according to court documents obtained by the Globe. During the divorce proceedings, Dorgan was living in Jacksonville, Florida, and worked as a truck driver, according to court documents. He registered to vote there as a Republican in 2020. John C. Parker, who met Dorgan while the two were members of the Jacksonville chapter of the Harley Owners Group, a motorcycle group also known as Jack's H. Hogg, said they were bonded over their love for hockey and motorcycles. Parker, who knew Dorgan was as Roberta, said his friend was really sweet, but said it was clear at times Dorgan was struggling. It was, I think, clear to me that she was troubled, said Parker. She never really spoke about it much, but I could always tell like she wasn't in a good place. Parker stopped hearing from Dorgan about 6 months ago. She kind of dropped off the face of the earth, said Parker. By 2022, Dorgan was living in Maine, according to friends. Emmy Lou Varian met Dorgan, whom she knew as Roberta, while they both worked at Bath Ironworks, the Maine shipbuilder. The company confirmed Dorgan worked there at the time of the shooting. In an interview, Varian recalled how they would play pool after their shifts and talk about everything under the sun. She also said Dorgan had a lot of struggles mentally. Another co-worker from Bath Ironworks, Sarah Graves, recalled that as a young man in a male-dominated field, She viewed Dorgan as a sign of relief at work. "She always made me feel safe," said Graves. Graves said Dorgan's children were all she ever talked about, and that Dorgan would often tell her about driving from Maine to Rhode Island on the weekends to attend events and games, sometimes sleeping in the car, so she could be there for her kids. But, Graves said, Dorgan told her Dorgan was not fully accepted by her family. "I'm not sure what the exchange of words could have been to push her over the edge," said Graves. "She worshipped the ground her ex-wife and her children walked on." Grief and disbelief after fall through ice. Relatives, friends of couples together over 50 years wonder what could have happened. They were former high school sweethearts, married for more than 5 decades, taking a walk on Valentine's Day morning with their beloved black Labrador along a remote stretch of Cape Cod. Then a bystander saw their dog, Casey, soaked and in distress, along a shoreline studded with 4-foot-high boulders of ice. When police arrived to help the animal, they heard cries for help, rising from swimmer among those jagged slabs that loomed above the swelling tide of the Bees River. 2 hours later, a woman's body was found in the river, and authorities are still searching for her husband somewhere in the icy waters. Now, communities up and down Lower Cape Cod remain deeply shaken as speculation swirls as to why a couple who were known to be avid outdoors people would venture onto such treacherous terrain, and when, if ever, rescue crews would recover the husband's body. Exactly what happened to Gerald and Kathleen Boucher, known as Jerry and Kit, both in their early 70s on their Valentine's Day walk, remains a mystery, and has come to dominate conversations, from the local brick restaurant and bar in Eastham to the Animal Rescue Center in Hyannis, where Kathleen had long volunteered, helping to rescue wounded and stranded mammals up and down the Cape. All day Tuesday, a steady stream of cars wound their way down the narrow road along First Encounter Beach to the desolate spot where rescue drivers discovered Kathleen's body Saturday. Many knew the couple and left bouquets of flowers on a mound of snow near the mouth of the Bees River. Some broke down in tears as they described the pair, animal lovers, selfless volunteers, outdoors enthusiasts, and devoted churchgoers. While remote, First Encounter Beach, so named because it is believed to be the site of the first encounter between pilgrims on the Mayflower and the Nossa tribe, is a popular destination for dog walkers, especially in winter. As the beach is closed off to dogs during the busy summer months, residents of Eastham said, Vivian Perry, who lives near the couple's home in Eastham and attended services with them at St. Joan of the Arc Catholic Church in Orleans, was overwhelmed with grief when she heard the rescue helicopters return to the beach early on Tuesday morning. "You couldn't find kinder, more giving people," said Perry, who would see them walk their dog around Eastham 2 or 3 times a day. "It's so profoundly sad that it happened on Valentine's Day." At the Yardham restaurants in Orleans, the late-lunch crowd was buzzing with talk of the tragedy. A group of retirees said that the Bouchers had just recently celebrated their 50th wedding anniversary, and the couple were outdoor enthusiasts who must have known the risks of venturing onto saltwater ice. A few were friends with Kit on Facebook and noted that just days before, she posted a photo of the snow-covered shore where she would die. Another photo Kit posted shows their black Labrador perched next to a dangerous icy crevasse along the shore. In the Facebook post, Kit wrote, apparently in jest, "When your dog looks at you with the 'that's a bad choice' look, 'Oh, really, dog? Let's chat.'" 2 police officers who initially arrived at the scene fell through the ice and were taken to the hospital after being unable to rescue the couple. Melon Regis, who has lived in the Cape since the early 1990s, keeps a police scanner in her kitchen. On Saturday, as she sat down to an English muffin with coffee, she heard a report of a lost and wet dog at First Encounter Beach. Then the scanner lit up with multiple distress calls of a woman under the ice and screaming for help, becoming more frantic as responders called for more help, she said. "My first thought was, how are they going to find her if she's under that ice? It's so thick," said Regis, growing emotional as she tied flowers onto a street sign near the makeshift memorial for the couple. "God love them. they must have gone after their dog. On Tuesday afternoon, Ron Rencurl of East Ham came to the edge of the heaving ice boulders, and he recalled the time that his son, a veterinarian, fell through the ice in Maine while pursuing his dog. "It's all very emotional," said Rencurl, a retired insurance salesman. "It's human impulse. Your dog runs out there on the ice, and it's your first impulse is to save him." Earlier Tuesday, roughly 20 rescue divers in wetsuits returned to the Bees River and searched for about 4 hours before the incoming tide brought large chunks of ice onto the river and cut short their effort, officials said. Multiple drones also provided an aerial search of the area, but visibility was hampered by the floating ice chunks. Officials said they were concerned that divers might get pinned underneath or between the large ice chunks. Additional searches may follow in the coming days, depending on ice conditions, police said. "At the moment, we're playing a game with the weather and environmental conditions, making sure that everyone is safe while they're searching," said Adam Bohannon, chief of the Easton Police Department. The couple met in the summer by school biology class where they were 15, and their relationship would last 56 years, a family member said. The Bouchers celebrated their 50th wedding anniversary last year, said their daughter, Katie Boucher. "They were so tight," she said by text message Tuesday. "Wonderful partners, but really good friends. Their relationship was truly a model. Affection, respect, fun, shared values." Originally from West Hartford, Connecticut, the two met in 1970 in summer school and were married 5 years later. The family only learned the details of that first meeting recently when the couple celebrated the 50th wedding anniversary with their two daughters, Katie Boucher said. "It led to so many amazing stories we had never heard before," she said. Kit Boucher, 71, studied education at Central Connecticut State University and worked as a kindergarten teacher at Bugby Elementary for 2 decades. Katie Boucher followed in her footsteps and also went education. "Even in retirement, Kit Boucher stayed in touch with many former students," her daughter said, "and several times a week would bring up one of their accomplishments. It would be impossible for me to keep track of them," she said. Jerry Boucher, 72, worked as an auto mechanic, HVAC technician, and gas fitter, his daughter said. He worked with Connecticut Natural Gas for 35 years. In his wife's phone contacts, he was simply Gas Man. In 2008, the couple moved to East Ham near the Cape Cod National Seashore, where they and their family had vacationed many times. They loved East Ham, their daughter said, simply because the ocean and bay were there. Both remained active in retirement. Jerry volunteered at the historic East Ham Windmill and worked with the Social Justice Club at St. Joan of Arc Church, their daughter said. Kit volunteered with the International Fund for Animal Welfare and would often take bikes or walks in the area. Karen Castiglione, a former animal rescue volunteer, said Kit was always quick to respond when there were reports of a wounded seal, dolphin, or other mammal washed ashore on the Cape. "Rescuing mammals is all very intense, and she loved doing it. Their dog, Casey, is physically okay, but very shaken by the ordeal," Katie Boucher said. "The Bouchers are survived by 6 grandchildren, their daughter said. "We are all heartbroken, but also know we can get through this together." Judge: ICE cannot re-detain Abrego Garcia. U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement cannot re-detain Kilmar Abrego Garcia because a 90-day detention period has expired and the government has no viable plan for deporting him, a federal judge ruled Tuesday. The Salvadoran's national case has become a focal point in the immigration debate after he was mistakenly deported to his home country last year. Since his return, he has been fighting a second deportation to a series of African countries proposed by the Department of Homeland Security. The government made one empty threat after another to remove him to countries in Africa with no real chance of success, U.S. District Judge Paula Zenas in Maryland wrote in her Tuesday order. From this, the court easily concludes that there is no good reason to believe removal is likely in the reasonably foreseeable future. Homeland Security Assistant Secretary Tricia McLaughlin criticized the ruling in an email. "If this matter was actually about the law or due process, Kilmar Abrego Garcia would already be deported and would never set foot in this country again. Judge Sinas will not be satisfied until he is authorized to live in the United States forever, she wrote. Abrego Garcia has an American wife and child, has lived in Maryland for years, but he immigrated illegally as a teenager. In 2019, an immigration judge ruled he could not be deported to El Salvador because he faced danger there from a gang that had threatened his family. By mistake, he was deported there anyway last year. Facing public pressure and a court order, President Trump's administration brought him back in June, but only after securing an indictment charging him with human smuggling. He has pleaded not guilty. Meanwhile, Trump officials have said he cannot stay in the United States. In court filings, officials have said they intended to deport him to Uganda, Eswatini, Ghana, and Liberia. Schools hunt for funds to keep mental health clinics. Launched in 2022, pilot program has record of success in bringing free urgent care to needy students at 23 locations across the state. A $5 million pilot program that supported free mental health clinics inside 23 public schools across the state is ending in June, leaving school officials and healthcare professionals scrambling to find new funding. Launched in 2022 and run by the Massachusetts Association for Mental Health, the program was the first in the state to provide free urgent mental health care at schools. By supplementing mental health teams with additional staff that offered free therapy sessions and long-term treatment plans for students, the program has helped drive down the number of suspensions, absences, and emergency 911 calls at schools. Massachusetts schools, with one psychologist for every 686 kids, has fewer healthcare professionals than the ratio of one for every 500 students recommended by the National Association of School Psychologists. The four-year pilot kicked off at a critical time, as the trauma of facing an unprecedented global pandemic, the growing pressures to perform on social media, and the shortage of healthcare professionals in schools combined to fuel an ongoing mental health crisis among children across the nation, according to the National Alliance on Mental Illness. The pilot program focused on districts with more low-income and English language learner students who are less likely to have access to mental health services at the school or through private insurance. The grant funding from three philanthropic foundations was only intended to get the program started. Now, with the grant expiring, schools are trying to replace the funds amid tighter local, state, and federal budgets for education. Providing mental health services in schools is the most powerful way that we can actually help kids and families, because that's where the majority of kids spend their time, said Joan Mikula, former Massachusetts Commissioner for Mental Health. Before the pilot program, Principal Keith Asher at the Washington Elementary in Springfield said he would call 911 and request an ambulance as often as once a week for students who had lost control of their emotions and thrown chairs or other objects. But with more in-school staff who could help kids having breakdowns, we maybe had two or three ambulance calls for the entire school year, Asher said. At Somerville High School, healthcare provider Cambridge Health Alliance was already running a clinic in the school when the grant program paid for an extra clinician, a social worker, and a bilingual specialist to speak with the parents. The additional assistance helped reduce the school's suspensions by half over the last year, from 61 in 2024 to 31, administrators said. Vanessa Nason, the social worker at Somerville High, paid for by the grant, said she uncovered how teenage social pressures were bogging down one highly spirited student who was suddenly skipping class and getting poor grades. Nason's evaluation helped determine that the teen needed more than just on-site therapy and got the teen's mother to agree to ongoing help at an outside clinic. The grants also paid for at least one bilingual professional at each school to help parents connect with their children's care. The bilingual professionals were able to give their parents insight into what their children needed, help them interact with school administrators, and show them how to navigate insurance for outside clinic care. "I speak Spanish and English, and I'm a parent," said Claudia Ortiz, the grant-funded family support specialist working at Somerville High. So it helps, because when I explain something to a parent, it's on equal terms, in a better way than they would hear it from the school. The pilot program in Somerville High and the other 22 schools had guaranteed backing only for 4 years from three philanthropic funds: the Mass General Brigham Community Benefit Fund, the Charles F. and Beatrice D. Adams Charitable Trust, and the American Endowment Foundation Anonymous Donor Advised Fund. Private funders typically support such new or experimental initiatives to get them off the ground. If the programs prove to be valuable, the nonprofits expect local, state, and federal funding streams to take over. The mental health services pilot has been extremely valuable, administrators said. Replacing the grant funding has been challenging at a time when municipal and state budgets are tight, and the Trump administration has been slashing student mental health aid. At Springfield's Washington's Elementary, Asher allocated $137,000 to keep the clinician originally funded by the grant on the school payroll full-time. Administrators at some of the other schools said they did not have available funds in their budgets to replace the grants. Dana Mauch, president of the Massachusetts Association for Mental Health, said she and her team have been working to find ways to sustain the program through a patchwork of third-party insurance, private grants, and state funds. School clinics could work with health care providers to build services to insurance coverage, some experts said, even though that approach would not cover all the resources funded by the grants, such as social workers and bilingual specialists. We may run into barriers, but I think most of us in the mental health field with kids believe that we can all sit at the table and work out the kinks, because this is worth working out, said Pam Sager, executive director of the Parent Professional Advocacy League, a nonprofit mental health group. Many students, however, either do not have insurance or mental health services are not covered by their policies. Not everybody has insurance company coverage, and because of some federal changes, more families might have coverage problems, Mauch said. Up to 350,000 people in Massachusetts are at risk of losing their Medicaid coverage over the next decade, according to a study published by the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities last year. Advocates of the free mental health services and school programs said they would also seek support at the state level, where at least five sources of funding have $11 million available for such support in schools, according to the State Department of Education. At the federal level, Massachusetts received nearly $20 million this year, but advocates say they could not count on future federal dollars. The Trump administration tried to cancel some programs last year, only to restore the funding amid a public outcry and legal challenges. Earlier this year, the administration threatened to cut hundreds of federal health grants, only to backtrack and reinstate the money. And last April, President Trump announced he would cancel funds secured by the Biden administration's Bipartisan Safer Communities Act, which set aside $1 billion to increase the number of mental health providers in schools. A federal judge restored the funds in December. Those who run the program at the Massachusetts Association for Mental Health said the in-school support is too valuable to lose. Our clinicians said that a lot of the students they reach never had access to behavioral health system before, said Jessica LaRochelle, the Association Directors for Public Policy and Governmental Relations. So it's critical that we find a way to keep this going. Bay State cuts hormone care for transgender youth. Bay State Health, the largest health system in western Massachusetts, will no longer prescribe hormones or puberty blockers to transgender patients under 18 in a move the system said would protect its Medicaid and Medicare funding. It's the latest retrenchment of gender-affirming care for minors in New England as hospitals and clinics across the region reassess services amid mounting federal and state restrictions. In October, Fenway Health, one of Boston's largest providers of LGBTQ plus health care, announced it would no longer offer gender-affirming medications to patients under 19. Last year, New Hampshire became the first state in New England to ban gender-affirming care for minors. And in Connecticut, two major hospitals stopped offering some or all gender-affirming care for minors. In a February 9th letter to parents and guardians, Springfield's Bay State Health said it would continue to offer mental health counseling for children and adolescents, but would stop prescribing gender-affirming hormone medications and puberty-blocking drugs to patients younger than 18. Medication care will be transferred to TransHealth, a local healthcare organization specializing in gender-affirming care, or to another provider of the patient's choice. The letter was signed by Dr. Matthew D. D.G. Guglielmo, pediatrician-in-chief at Bay State Health. This decision offers patients the specialized expertise and continuity of care they need and deserve and reflect the evolving regulatory landscape that threatens hundreds of millions of dollars in hospital Medicaid and Medicare funding, Bay State said in a separate statement to the Globe. Nearly 70% of Bay State Health patients rely on Medicaid and Medicare, and preserving access to care for these individuals and all others in the community is a responsibility we take seriously. TransHealth, also based in Western Massachusetts, did not immediately respond Tuesday to the Globe's request for comment. The recent changes follow a series of proposals by the Trump administration aimed at sharply restricting gender-affirming medical care for minors. Under the proposals, the federal government would bar hospitals that participate in Medicare and Medicaid from providing gender-affirming care, including hormones, puberty blockers, and surgery for patients under 18. A separate rule would block federal Medicaid and Children's Health Insurance Program funding for such treatment for youth 19 and younger. Because nearly every hospital in the United States relies on federal reimbursement, health policy experts have warned that the changes could amount to a virtual national ban. Already, Bay State is digging itself out of a financial hole. The health system issued several rounds of layoffs in the last 2 years, including cutting 117 jobs on February 13th in an effort to find financial stability. Nationwide, 26 states have banned the use of hormones and puberty blockers for transgender minors, according to advocacy groups tracking such laws after the U.S. Supreme Court upheld Tennessee's ban last June, reinforcing the legality of such restrictions. Gender-affirming care for minors, which can include mental health counseling, puberty blockers, hormone therapy, and in rare cases surgery, is considered medically necessary by major professional health organizations, including the American Academy of Pediatrics and the Endocrine Society. Those groups say the treatments can reduce gender dysphoria and improve mental health outcomes, including lowering the risk of depression and suicide. Dr. Robbie Goldstein, the state's public health commissioner, said gender-affirming care remains legal in Massachusetts and defended it as evidence-based treatment. Recent federal actions threatening hospital funding have put providers in an impossible position, he said. Decisions about a young person's medical care belong to the exam room, guided by patients, families, and clinicians, not by politicians in Washington, Goldstein said. According to federal health data, about 3.3% of U.S. high school students identify as transgender or non-binary. Fewer than 0.1% of adolescents with private health insurance identified as gender diverse and received puberty blockers and gender-affirming hormone treatments between 2018 and 2022, according to a recent study by researchers at the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health. Critics of the treatments argue that minors are too young to make decisions with potentially irreversible consequences, and that such interventions should be delayed until adulthood. Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. has said that physicians who provide gender-affirming care to minors are violating the Hippocratic Oath to do no harm, and has characterized gender transition surgeries as causing lasting physical and psychological damage. Recently, two major medical groups have stated that gender-affirming surgeries should wait until adulthood. The American Medical Association told reporters earlier this year that surgical interventions in minors should be deferred generally to adulthood, while the American Society of Plastic Surgeons said gender-affirming surgery should be delayed until a patient is at least 19 years old, although the society said it respects the individual decision-making of its members. Already, these procedures are exceedingly rare among minors in the United States. Advocates for transgender youth say the growing patchwork of restrictions has created confusion and anxiety for families, even in states where no formal ban exists. Massachusetts has positioned itself as a refuge for transgender patients, with state leaders pledging to protect access to care. Earlier this year, when the Trump administration subpoenaed records from Boston Children's Hospital and several others nationwide that provide gender-affirming care, Attorney General Andrea Campbell led a coalition of 19 states in fighting the administration. The suit is ongoing. Families have filed discrimination lawsuits against two of Connecticut's largest pediatric health systems after abruptly ending gender-affirming care for minors. Boston College psychologist Amy Tishelman said that while medical treatment for gender dysphoria should be approached carefully, eliminating access altogether would halt research needed to determine when such interventions might be effective. Tishelman was a clinician and director of research at Boston Children's Hospital Gender Clinic for 8 years and a lead author of the International Standards of Care for Treatment of Gender-Diverse Children. It's really heartbreaking to see the ping-pong around all-or-nothing approaches, Tishelman said Tuesday. It's clear we need a careful process, but it's hard to fathom that services will disappear altogether. She emphasized that for young people and their families, there's often a complex set of risks and benefits to contemplate before starting medical interventions. Tishelman said that for youth who don't have access to puberty blockers, it means they will go through a puberty incompatible with their identified gender, which can be distressing for some. But, she added, not everybody wants puberty blockers, citing complexities and risks associated with their use, including potential fertility impacts and implications for future gender-affirming surgeries. Tishelman said she'd like to see psychologists front and center, developing more research and priorities before cutting off care because there are risks. There's also a lack of data to predict who will need the medication, she said. These decisions must be careful and made in light of education about what is known or unknown. Risks of delaying care are individualized and can be quite extreme for some people, she said. Falling short of the dream, how athletes cope with the mental toil of Olympics. When Ilya Malinin came to the mixed zone after his disastrous free skate, he was vulnerable about what was going on inside. Going into that starting pose, I just felt like all the traumatic moments of my life really just started flooding my head, the American figure skater said. It was just so many negative thoughts that just flooded into there and I just did not handle it. Malinin, the 21-year-old superstar, fell twice and lost out on a medal after he was widely expected to not just win gold, but crushed the competition. A day later, another 21-year-old superstar, American speed skating phenom Jordan Stoltz, edged rival Yenning de Bouw of the Netherlands by 0.11 seconds in the 500 meters. It was Stoltz's second race of these Winter Olympics, and he said the nerves were calmer than before the 1,000 last Wednesday, which he also won. He said when he got up to the line for the 1,000, they said, "Go to the start." He looked up and saw the stands and said to himself, "This is a really big deal," Stoltz's coach, Bob Corby, said Saturday. Corby and his team said they'd been downplaying what Stoltz was about to do. "You don't have to do anything different than what you always do, because at this level, the name of the game is reducing distractions," Corby said. "And one of the biggest distractions is the Olympics." There's a fine line between mental performance and mental health, and these elite athletes, many younger than you realize until you see them in person, walk it every day in their careers. But yes, it's the Olympics. During a typical season, these athletes compete each weekend to accumulate World Cup points and prize money. Not here. It's one shot. You either nail it or you don't. Connecticut short track speed skater Kristen Santos Griswold couldn't shake that notion from her mind in 2022. "Every single thing I did was like, how is this going to affect me at the Olympics?" she said. "I ate right. I slept right. I trained right. I did everything right, and it still didn't happen for me." With just one lap to go in the 1,000-meter medal race in Beijing, Santos Griswold was tripped up by another skater and finished fourth. The other competitor was called for a penalty, but it didn't change the result. It took Santos Griswold a year before she could bring herself to watch the race. She considered quitting the sport altogether. The pain of what happened felt like too much to come back from. Santos Grizzle pointed to the work she did with mental skills coach to help her process what happened and made the decision to come back in 2026. She's going to leave these games without a medal again, but this time it feels different. I learned that I'm not defined by the medals, Santos Grizzle said after she's knocked out of the 500-meter competition in the quarterfinals last Thursday. I work really hard every day, and I'm coming out here and giving it my all, and that's all I can do. Santos Grizzle is 31 and has a bit more perspective than she did in her 20s. Plus, she's still one of the greatest at what she does, winning the Crystal Globe last season for best overall speed skater in the world. That applies to alpine skier Michaela Schifrin, too. In 2022, Schifrin was hounded by fans on social media after leaving Beijing without a medal despite five tries in individual events. She had been propped up as the American to watch and didn't deliver. Now, Schifrin is off for another middling start in these games. She missed out a medal in the team combined and the giant slalom. She'll race in the slalom, her best event, on Wednesday for one more shot at a fourth medal. The Olympics ask us to take a real risk on the world stage, Schifrin wrote on Instagram over the weekend, one that requires courage and vulnerability to erroneous judgment and narratives built on a limited understanding of what this sport truly demands. And it all matters in the story of becoming the best version of ourselves. When the Olympics are over, she'll return to the FIS World Cup, where she's far and away the top slalom skier in the world. She's also got the most wins on tour of any alpine skier in history, man or woman. The Olympics don't define her, despite what we all might believe. And that seems to be true for most athletes here, as the bright lights that shine every 4 years get hotter and hotter. I'm grateful to be here, motivated and excited for what's next, and proud to be part of this American team, Schifrin wrote. May we all champion one another and tread lightly on what we don't fully comprehend and have the fortitude to keep showing up. How a collection of small farms revived Vermont maple syrup. Just as the taste of wine, coffee, cocoa, and even milk that becomes cheese is shaped by their origins, the flavor of maple syrup can also reflect its terroir. The French term captures the unique combination of region, soil, and climate that influences the trees and ultimately the sap and syrup they yield. Vermonter Corey Krieg understands this full well, and he knows the maple syrup business from every angle. As both a maple's producer in Bethel, sugaring season runs from mid-February to early April, and an electrical engineer, he launched Maple Farmers, a collective of small family farmers around Vermont that craft syrup in small batches the traditional way, boiled over wood fires and rustic sugar houses. The syrup is never blended, and each glass bottle displays the farm's name. Krieg built the platform and sells the farmer's syrups directly to customers under the Maple Farmers label. He launched the company during the pandemic, when small-scale producers were struggling to compete with larger operations, even as demand for maple syrup was soaring. Everyone was home eating pancakes, Krieg said. But farmers markets, their primary sales outlet, had shut down. Meanwhile, larger producers that use the quicker reverse osmosis process can strip subtle flavors and have bulk packing contracts for capitalizing on the surge. Krieg saw the sales tipping unfairly and decided to act. Many of the producers also run dairy farms, grow vegetables or flowers, and juggle other trades like carpentry, plumbing, or stonemasonry. Thanks to Krieg, they found a new market for their syrups and a way to thrive. What started with just five farms represented on the label has blossomed into a dozen. The producers offer four distinct flavor profiles: golden for delicate taste, amber color for richer taste, dark and robust, and very dark for those who crave intensity. Choose from half-pint bottles at $10, pints at $16, or quarts at $26. Half-pint sampler collections start at $29. A fun gift is the 8.5-ounce glass tree bottle adorned with a little metal sap bucket decorating its neck, $20. To order, go to maplefarmers.com, where you can also learn about each farmer and find a tutorial on maple syrup. Thank you for joining me for this edition of the Boston Globe. Have a great day.